Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual perfection.
Let my mind be ever attuned to Thee.
Let my soul ever sing Thy praises.
And let my love flow out to all the world.
And to Thy feet alone.
Om.
Om.
Om. Ran across this funny that it's a cartoon. I'll have to show you the picture, but I'll describe it also. Stanley was deeply disappointed when in the high Tibetan mountains he finally met his true self. It shows a young backpacker type person with a walking stick meeting his true self, which is dressed in a suit and a valise and a little umbrella, and it's a businessman. Which of course made me think of Lari Mahasya. So I thought I'd read to you an account by Swami Satyananda, Master's brother disciple. And he oftentimes looked at Master as his own guru as well. And so he wrote this account. So in any case, as he is wandering in the mountains one afternoon, he heard someone calling his name, Lahiri, Lahiri, from somewhere up. He was taken aback, hearing his name being called in this unknown, uninhabited place. Somewhat anxious to satisfy his curiosity, he sought to find the source of the voice. He grew tired after walking quite a while and saw the sun was going down. Even though he was feeling some trepidation, he kept on walking, just to have audience with a sadhu and to resolve this mystery. Eventually, he came upon a clean and well-kept cave at the top of a mountain. A tall, divinely radiant sadhu was standing there, a beatific, joyful smile on his face. It seemed that this holy man was standing there because he was waiting for Lari Mahasya to come. Laughing warmly, Sadhuji said in Hindi, Shyam Sharan, come and rest here, I was calling you. Sri Shyam Sharan was surprised to hear his name from this unknown sadhu. All kinds of ideas and thoughts about the situation were spinning in his head, but some sort of attraction pulled him to follow the Sadhuji into the cave. Entering, he found some asanas, material or seat for sitting on a floor for meditation, and kamandalas, sacred water pots, and other such things that were used by ascetic monks. Sadhuji pointed to an asana at a particular part of the cave and asked, "Do you recognize this asana?" Lari Mahasaya was dumbstruck at the question, and the more he looked at Sadhuji's gently laughing countenance, everything seemed to make less and less sense. Still, he was beginning to feel some kind of familiar attraction towards this unknown place. Sadhuji touched him and gently caressed his head with affection. Suddenly it seemed that Shyam Sharan, that he just awoke from a deep sleep. He saw that this was his own place of sadhana and his own asana. How familiar this cave was, and how familiar was this extraordinary Mahatma who was standing with him, his external and deathless Sri Gurudev. It all came back to him. In his last life, he had become a sannyasi, and in the presence of Sri Guru, became absorbed in sadhana in this very place. Later, he left his body. Overwhelmed by remembering all this, Sri Sham Charan collapsed at the Sri Guru's feet and immediately begged to receive complete shelter in him. Gurudev's tranquil words of consolation and solace brought some relief to Lari Mahashya's mind. He then came to know that it was Sri Guru's divine power that had caused him to be suddenly relocated to Raniket. Though he didn't want to return to his present life after having surrendered all to his Guru's feet, upon Sri Guru's instructions, Lari Mahashya returned to the Raniket office. He began attending satsang on different mountains at the feet of his Guru, administering medicine and proper nutrition and gradually bringing Sham Charan to the physically pure and healthy state. Saduji sat him down on his asan and initiated him in the rare and priceless path of Kriya Yoga Sadhana. The dust and dullness of consciousness was removed. The radiance of divine knowledge appeared. His initiation was complete. And the translator's note is, the terms Diksha Prapta is emphasized by Swami Satyananda. In Western terms, it is similar meaning to being born again. This was not only a sacred moment for him, but for all mankind. It was the beginning of recovering the lost treasure. So many thirsty men and women would now find a place to quench their yearning with the rejuvenating water of life. It was as if Mother Ganges herself began flowing to the helpless devotees as Mandakini, her heavenly form. That holy moment was a hidden event, unseen by people in an undiscovered and secret cave. For beings praying for shelter, for the distressed and desperate, for sincere seekers, the powerful seed of the tree that would be their future sanctuary was now being planted with the greatest love and care. Blessed and grateful was this Arya noble land, this India, Guru of the world. Pure and sanctified, Sri Sham Charan sat on the sacred asana and began to ascend the different levels of pranayam kriya yoga, experiencing worlds of incredible wonder. The outward bound senses were withdrawn and rested within. He became immersed in beatific awareness. The Lord was samadhisthi, absorbed in samadhi. How time disappeared. Where was the office? Where was the job? Where was his domestic life? Coming out of samadhi, he fell at Sri Guru's lotus feet and begged to remain with his divine presence forever. The taste of the Satchitananda-filled Brahman made him want to leave everything behind. Guru Mahamuni Babaji Maharaj lovingly embraced him and said he would still have to fulfill his worldly duties for a few more years, and that Kriya Yoga Sadhana would spread to the people of the world through his presence in the world. Realizing his new responsibility, Sri Sham Charan submitted reverently to Sri Guru's order. He then asked how he might see his Guru again. Sri Guru assured him, "Whenever you think of me, I will be there." And of course, we are all the recipients of those living waters that got released at that initiation and at that time. And reading from the Cross and Lotus Journal from Mother, we must realize we are not a religion, we are not a church, we are not an organization. We seek but to do one thing alone, and that is to focus our full attention upon God through Christ, through the infinite universal Christ, who is firstborn, as it says in the scriptures, of every creature. And when we can do that, when we can forget all about ourselves, everything in this world, in service for Him, and love for Him, and devotion for Him, and work for Him alone, and live a balanced life, not one-sided, not all meditation, not all work, not all play, but each of these things must be taken into consideration. A man has a responsibility to his family. He has a responsibility for the upkeep of his house, for the things that go on. He has a responsibility for supporting them. He has a responsibility to rest. This is for himself. I'm afraid I neglected that one. But anyway, he has these things, and he must divide his time equally among them. But the greatest of all is to keep the remembrance of God, to keep his name upon your lips, no matter what you are doing. Because I don't care whether you are playing, whether you are working, whether you are relaxing, or what you are doing. You can remember God, and you can remember him, that it is his doing all things through you, and every act which you do is in service to him. Going to read that again. Because I don't care whether you are playing, whether you are working, whether you are relaxing, or what you are doing, you can remember God, and you can remember that it is his doing all things through you, and that every act which you do is in service to him. This is constant. It is deep meditation and never ceases until your heart becomes one with him, until it becomes lifted up, until your whole being is filled with the infinite light and presence of that one who is divine. And when that day comes, when you find that he is yourself and you are he, it will all be the greatest awakening, the greatest birthday of your life, because then you will find out what Christ said, unless you are born again the second time, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. So we were born in this earthly sense, but we must be born in the Spirit of God. So when that day comes, the radiance and the glory of God will pour forth, and you will become a light on a hilltop, a beacon to show all men the way and the truth of God. God's richest blessings be upon you all. May he lift you up and show you the radiance and glory of that which you really are in him. Such tremendous truths that we have been given. And it is incumbent upon us to put these truths into action. The great thing about the path that we follow is it's not learning just a foreign language or different words or memorizing texts. It is a thing of action. It is a thing of doing and becoming. You may say that in the beginning, it all starts with bhakti. Bhakti is that irresistible pull, that loving attraction that we feel towards God. Now, God, in one sense, is just a name, just a word. But it represents so much. It is that cosmic consciousness. It is that infinite love. It is the uplifting bliss. It is the radiant wisdom. It is the everythingness that you can think of in terms of the good and the beautiful. And it all resides right within us. This is the great thing. The great thing. But we feel this irresistible pull because we don't have that knowledge and that experience of that beatific upliftment as a constant thing. Perhaps we're touched and we have some particular experience. And we recognize that everything else in our life pales into insignificance. That grace descends upon us. Some people have a particular spiritual upliftment and experience. Other people have a near-death experience. Some people just somehow intuitively know and understand that there is something more for them to attain, something higher, something better. I remember having a client one time when I was doing my counseling practice, and she had a multiple personality disorder. And her life story was one beginning in hell. She was inducted, born into a family that practiced black magic and devil worship, and she was used as an object of that worship. and many horrible things happened, and as a means of trying to survive, she divided her personality into parts. You remember, even as a small baby, looking up at a light bulb and seeing the light and the warmth in the bulb, and she was in such a terrible condition in her physical body and what surrounded her that she projected herself into the light bulb, and she found warmth and comfort there. And she learned how to divide her mind in that way, and then the mind just kept dividing as experience after experience came to her. And I found it amazing that all through her childhood and upbringing, that she was surrounded by this philosophy of devil worship, literal devil worship, and all the things that went with it. And yet she knew somehow deep in her soul that there was something better, something higher. Nobody told her this. Everybody was there to convince her of quite the opposite. But she hung on to it. And as a result of that, she was seeking out healing. And a great deal of healing came to her in our work together. But this is a wonderful thing in the sense that she had this inborn knowledge. And when you look at people who go through horrific experiences, so many times they feel they know on some level this isn't right, even though their entire environment tells them that this is normal, this is what life is. And they reach out for something higher, and sometimes because of that comparison between what they know inside and what goes on in the external, they become discouraged. And they even can come to the point where they will take their own lives because they identify with their body. They come to the belief that if their body is no longer in existence, then their pain will be gone. Now, it's an interesting question I used to when I worked with folks so often who had chronic suicide and just constantly thought of ending their lives. And it was with this relief in mind that if they ended the body, they ended their pain. And so I would ask them, what if that's not true? And they would look rather shocked. They had never considered that before. I said, what if you have to continue to work at it until you work through this? And then they say, well, then killing myself doesn't make any sense at all. And hopefully by introducing that small little bit of doubt, it would keep them from doing a great harm against themselves. We imagine oftentimes that when we die, we will be judged. But the truth is that the truth exists inside of you. And that judgment doesn't come from something outside of you. It comes from your deepest knowledge of yourself. When you are released from this body, you are released from the confines of body consciousness alone, and you are put into more close touch with the divine consciousness within you. And therefore, you can judge yourself. And you do. And you know the things that you did that were wrong, and you know the things that you did that were right. You know whether you fulfilled your mission when you came into this body. We all come with a plan. We all come with ideas of what it is that we would like to accomplish. Not everybody has come to seek out God alone in the highest sense. Not everybody is prepared for that. But everybody comes to live in the light, the highest light that they know. That may be, for them, attaining a state of good health. It may be, for them, running a business in a righteous, dharmic kind of a way. It can be in healing relationships and having a good family life. Not everybody comes into this world prepared or ready to ascend that final mile into highest God realization. So we shouldn't project that onto everybody, but tune in to what that individual has come to do and to help them to the best of our ability to live up to what it is that they've come to do. But when you have come into this life, in order to realize God, then we start out with the bhakti, with that attraction and love for truth, for light, for bliss, for upliftment of consciousness, and being born again, or as in India it is called, being twice born. Now in India, coming through the Kali Yuga as we have done, there has been so much emphasis put onto the body. And there instead, as Krishna points out that Brahman is a state to be attained, they have reduced it to the family that you're born into. It's a thing of blood, it's a thing of genetics. And so if you're born into a certain family, about the time that you're 7 or 8 years old, you're given a thread. It has 5 different threads on it. What it means is that you have overcome the body. Now, no formality of this kind and nothing that just because you're born into a certain family prepares you for that. This is something that is a state to be attained. It's not something that can just be handed to you through a ceremony. So this is what happens in the Kali Yuga when everything is identified so closely with matter, with the world, with your body, is that things are seen to be handed down through families instead of states to be attained. And so this bhakti is beginning that path to be born again, to be twice born. And just as a baby is not born overnight, first comes conception. And the spermatozoa and the ovum come together and form one cell. Even so, within your own body, as Mother teaches us, the pineal and the pituitary glands both have secretions. And it's a virginal birth because the two glands stay apart, but those secretions come together and they form a cell, a Christ cell. And this is the beginning of what can evolve into full Christ consciousness within yourself. And so this starts with great love and great devotion, great attraction for God, to where you learn the methods and the ways. This is karma yoga. So following the bhakti yoga of love and attraction for God comes karma yoga. Now, as Lari Mahasya defined karma yoga, that kriya yoga, which has its roots in karma, is an action, is an activity. All meditation, as it is taught, is a method. And so I say that it is both a verb and a noun. It is a verb in that it is an action. And it is something that we begin to act. It is also a noun in the sense that meditation is a state that we can attain to and that we become. But we're not there yet. And so we initiate this karma yoga. Karma yoga is also looking at your life and what you do in life, and that your activities are a place of service to God, God within others, God within yourself, God for society, God for this entire world. And you seek to serve God. Mother Teresa of Calcutta began her mission. She was serving the Christ in the poorest of the poor. And there were many who were attracted to her work. And there were some who wanted to cure all diseases, to stop all hunger and all the rest of it. All deprivation. And they saw it as a social cause. And Mother Teresa sometimes earned disrepute within these circles because she was spiritually oriented. Christ said a very interesting thing one time. He said, "The poor you shall have with you always." There will always be disparity that cannot be helped in this world of duality. It doesn't mean that there need to be people who are starving and going without, but there will always be differences. That is the nature of this dual world. So Mother Teresa was not out, had not set out to stop all of these differences. What she was there was to serve Christ in every person that she met, to love him, to serve him. That may have been just picking him up off the streets in some diseased body that was in a state close to death. She would take them to her place. And then she would clean them and put clean clothes on them and give them clean sheets and give them some dignity and give them as much comfort as she could. And sometimes it was just in the very last stages of their life. And to her, this was an activity of the heart. She was loving her Lord through everyone that she met in this way. Can you imagine? Somebody may be working at a convenience store or a McDonald's or other such place and say, well, that doesn't seem like a very noble mission. That doesn't sound like Mother Teresa, and plus they're paying me money for it. But a person has to live, and a person has to have shelter and all the rest of it, so receiving money is not evil. But to transform what you do, to put the vibration of love and service to God into whatever it is that you do, whatever vocation or advocation that you are drawn to, you make that your service to God. You do it perfectly for God. Herwin once told the story of as a young man, and they were doing some work for Mother. They were building a fence, and some of the wood that they got was not quite straight. But they were building the fence, and when Mother took a look at it, she says, well, these pieces aren't perfect. And Herwin and others, they'd been working a long day, and they were tired, and they said, well, you know, you're just not going to get perfect pieces of wood. No, I want this to look perfect. So they had to tear apart part of the fence, find more perfect wood, put it up. Mother was teaching them. She is teaching them to look for perfection in what you do, in what you do, to make it a perfect gift to God. That when you have a guest come to your home, that is God coming to your home. When you're serving someone a meal, you're serving God that meal. So whether you are at home, whether you're at work, whether you are at play, this always comes into mind. So you begin with bhakti, the great love and devotion for God, and then you begin to actuate that into karma yoga. And then you rise up into jnana yoga. Jnana yoga is the discernment, is the differentiation. As Ramakrishna Paramahansa said, not this, not that. Because the mind can say what God is not, but it is very poor at articulating what God is. So you begin to separate out those things which are not of God. And as you enter into the state of jnana, first it is learning the do's and the don'ts, the Ten Commandments, those things that we are asked to do and not to do, the yamas and the niyamas. And we begin to clarify that in our own mind, and as we do so, our mind becomes more purified. When the mind becomes more purified, we enter into an intuitive knowing of what is right and what is wrong. We feel it, we know it deep within ourselves. This is a much more exacting commandment because we begin to live in this world where we feel that even a small transgression is something that is painful. Sri Yukteswarji told that when he is serving upon this high astral planet, it's actually astral heaven, it exists above the astral spheres. It's a very high, refined area. When beings who are there make any form of mistake at all, it causes them a great deal of pain because they feel it keenly. It's not just an idea that they've accepted of the right thing to do. They know it deep within themselves. And if they make some even slight transgression against it, it causes them such great pain. Papa described this when he was a wandering sadhu. And there was a certain place there that would feed sadhus, but they would only feed them one day, and if you came back the next, they didn't feed you. Papa was standing in line with the other sadhus, and there was another sadhu standing there who had been there the previous day, and they refused to serve him, and he was left standing outside. And he went in with the crowd, and he started eating. Then he started thinking of this hungry sadhu who was left outside the gates. And he is so distressed with himself that he had entered into those gates when there is somebody else who is still hungry. And he left that place, and it was as if he was in a daze. He was in terrible spiritual pain because he felt he had gone against something that was deep within his own soul. And he wandered through the town, and it took him a long time to recover from that. And a reasonable person could say, well, you know, that was the rules and nothing he could do about it and so on. But that's not how Papa felt about it. And so when we awaken to that state of Jnani, that state of discernment, intuitive discernment, we follow a very exacting master. Now, Mother said, when you go all the way, you go beyond the law. And there are those who purport that they have gone beyond the law. But we cannot play fast and loose with these rules. We can't say, oh, yes, I've risen above all of that, when that's not the truth. Karma goes very deep into our soul, the law of cause and effect. And ignorance of the ego mind is very subtle, very subtle. And that is why we must maintain an attitude, the proper attitude toward God, that God is the higher intelligence, higher power, always beyond ourselves. We can merge into God and feel our oneness with God. But God, as long as we have any sense of individuality whatsoever, is the supreme consciousness that exists above us. And we live in service to God and Guru. We always feel that we are the humble child. When Papa Ram Dass met with Anande Moy Ma, it's always wonderful and uplifting and sometimes entertaining for all the devotees who are around. And when Papa was talking with Anande Moy Ma, Ma said that she was but the child. And Papa said, no, 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 Ram Dass was only the child. She said, no, you are my father. I am just your child. Papa said, how can that be? Look, I have no hair. I have no teeth. I'm just like a little baby. I am your child. You are the mother. Well, she couldn't beat that, so she had to be satisfied. And it's a wonderful truth. You know, it's fun, it's entertaining, but it's also a wonderful truth that true spiritual masters always feel that they're the most humble ones, not because they've orchestrated some kind of humility. They feel it deep within themselves. There is a story, I don't remember who was telling it, but it's a Mohammedan. And the story goes something to the effect that they were asking who was greater, this one particular saint or Mohammed. And the answer was that Muhammad was, because the saint had said, I have become God. But Muhammad said, I am always in the lesser position than God, and God is great. And so as long as we have a human ego, as long as there is any sense of separation within ourselves, it is best to keep our forehead at the feet of God, always, always. And to feel that God is orchestrating everything and that we are His servant. That is, Ram Dass means the servant of God. And you think, servant, well, I don't know if I want to be someone's servant. I don't know if I want to be their slave. Because we associate that with having less freedom. But the truth is that when we come into our state of oneness and we have completely surrendered ourselves to God, then we merge into His infinite being, and that is complete freedom. It turns the world on its head. And so that sense of service, that sense of surrender, that sense of discernment leads us into a state of, yes, servitude and slavedom. But it also leads us to our complete and total emancipation and freedom. It's a hard thing to completely understand until we experience it completely. And then going from the state of jnana, we go into the state of raja. Raja yoga is the state of meditation. And as I said before, you can say that meditation is both a verb and a noun. And now it becomes a noun. In karma yoga, it's a verb. Now we become that. We merge with that. We have union with that, which we have so long yearned to be a part of. And we feel now that God is inhabiting this form, that it is no longer the individuality of I. I now has taken its proper place as the observer, and I was observing what God does within. And that is God who loves through you. It is God who acts and speaks through you. It is God who discerns with you, through you. And it is God who inhabits you completely and totally. This is the state of yoga. This is the state of union. And so you merge your little self into the great self, the great being of God. And you go through a period of time when you feel that this world is but a dream, and that God alone is real, spirit is real, everything else seems ephemeral. And then as that consciousness is purified inside of you, more and more and more, you begin to see this world as a divine manifestation. It is no longer as much ephemeral or unreal or dreamlike as it is scintillating and filled with divine spirit. Each person that you meet, you see that God inhabits them in their heart. Otherwise, they could not have life. They could not have breath. They could not speak. Now, it doesn't mean, from a human standpoint, that everything that they do is godlike. Not at all. But you know that it is God within who dwells within them, and they may exist in a state of separation and ignorance. But it is God alone who is within them, and therefore God should be honored. And you feel God within them. You see God within them. Once again, Papa said that it was his thought that the greatest thing he could do for anyone else is to see God within them. That is the place of discernment, isn't it? And so you look to do that. And he said an amazing thing one time, because he talks about the universal vision and how he came into that up on the hill of Arunachala after seeing Ramana Maharshi, and that he switched from in quest of God to the envision of God. And then the world is God. And yet it was 10 years after he established the ashram, he said, before he overcame the last vestiges, because he still held on to some anger about the men who had attacked Mataji, because every day he saw evidence of pain in her body, in her back, because of what they had done to her. And finally, one of the fellows came to the ashram, and he admitted to what he did, and he felt sorry for it now. And Papa let go of any last vestige that he had a right to judge, and that there is anything but God in all this world. When we look out through these two eyes, we see much in this world that does not reflect the highest consciousness, the divine consciousness. That much is plain. And yet, when we enter into that divine state, we see that this entire world is scintillating with divine consciousness. Now, that cannot be rectified in a human sense. It is only through the divine vision that we can come into that state of consciousness where we can say the world is God. It is not becoming God. It is God. Because we see it, we feel it, we know it with every part of our beings. This is being twice born. This is the fulfillment of what Jesus and what all the great masters speak of as attaining this great and wonderful consciousness. Now, as I said before, this is not something that happens overnight. It is something that we must strive for. Plato once called himself the midwife, and he was helping to give birth to a new state of consciousness in those who came to him. And so the birth is a struggle. It is painful. It is the coming forward of something brand new. And when this kundalini force is unleashed inside of you, and you feel it, you have to surrender to it. You have to give yourself over to it. In the Bible, it says that you are moved so many cubits this way and so many cubits that way. And it is describing as this kundalini power takes you over. And you feel the power of God pouring through you so greatly. It pours through you so much that you can recoil from it. You can stand back from it. The disciples of Ramakrishna asked him, they said, why is it that your body has gone through so much suffering in order to realize God? He said, well, it's like this. It's as if you're a small hut and there's an elephant inside the hut. And if the elephant moves a little bit this way and a little bit that way, it threatens to collapse the entire hut. He says, that's the way that it is in this body, and God is moving inside of it. And I can tell you the truth of it, that this is the way that it feels. And it strikes at the raw nerves of every part of your ego consciousness. It strikes at all the weaknesses and all the tender points. And that is why we must surrender so completely, so fully at God's feet. We must see that whatever He orchestrates for us is perfect, perfect in Him. This is a training of the mind, you see, and it's an act of the mind. It's not the full realization. But one thing the masters discovered, when they attained their own full God realization, they were then faced with, how do I teach this? How do I convey it? How do I prepare disciples in order to know it? So they taught them the different stages that they themselves went through. And that if the disciples focused their mind on those stages, learning discernment, learning service, learning to see the world as God, they could quicken their evolution. Kriya is this way. Kriya is a natural movement of the life force within your own spine and your own brain. But Babaji so beautifully and lovingly devised this method to replicate what goes on naturally within a God-realized soul, so that you may quicken your progress, and that when you put your full attention upon the breath and upon the spine and the brain, and you circulate this force in this particular way, that you can attune yourself to the highest divine consciousness. It helps purify your spine and your brain, which are the vehicles through which realization comes to you. We are of such a magnificent design. It is remarkable, and that is just on the physical level, that is very true. But when we get into these esoteric levels of how the body, the mind, the astral body, the causal body are all designed and all come into functioning, and how spirit, the Satchitananda, can come into you and begin to express itself through you, it is fantastic. It really is. And so this Christ seed makes its way up through the spine and all the centers of the spine, which represent every aspect of your consciousness. And so you are faced with yourself, and you have to overcome what it is that you find. Now, it's very tempting to just go with it because you've so long identified with these conscious and deep subconscious states of mind. And so you can just go with it. It feels natural. It feels like yourself because you have such a long history with it. But we have to fight that. We have to change the direction and keep our attention constantly going to God. Now, the masters know that love is the greatest attraction in this entire world. And when you feel that love, you don't have to discipline yourself. There's that lovely young soul that I saw in the ashram near Dwarhat. And after his long days of work, I would see him run, literally run, to the Bhajan hall in his free time. Work was done. And he could go there and he could play the harmonium and sing master's chants. What a beautiful example. He didn't go in to lie down and have a rest. He was running to the Bhajan hall. How many of us have that feeling of running to God? Running to God. Master's own father, when they went to go visit the Swami Pranabananda, saint with two bodies. And he said to his master's father, look at your son. He is running to God. What are you doing with yourself? What are you doing with yourself? And sometimes we need to be awakened, jolted. What are you doing with yourself? Are you putting your shoulder fully to the wheel? Are you keeping your mind on God? Mother gave us such a simple practice. Keep your mind on God. Keep it glued to God. And where your mind goes to, you will follow. It reminded me of a football coach that I had one time, and we did what we called an arm shuck, where you hit the fellow on the side of the head on his helmet. And our coach explained to us that wherever the head of the body went, the rest of the body would follow. And true enough, it turned out to be true. I didn't dislocate any heads. But when you change the direction of the head, you change the direction of the body. And so it is with us in the mind. Wherever your powerful mind puts its attention, that is what you will be steered towards. You will follow. So we have to learn jnana. First as a mental practice, a discipline, but then it comes to us as an intuitive wisdom and direction. And we feel it constantly and continually. This is such a terrific path, and we have been given such terrific principles, but we have to put them into practice ourselves. This is the way that it must be. And so reading again from the journal and Master's writing, The Mirror of Silence. When you find that your soul, your heart, every wisp of inspiration, every speck of the vast blue sky, every shining blossom of the sky, the mountains, the earth, the whippoorwill, and the bluebells are all tied with one chord of rhythm, one chord of joy, one chord of unity, and one chord of spirit, then you know that nothing exists but the waves of his cosmic sea. I feel him like a gentle breath of bliss, breathing in my body of universes. I perceive him shining through the bright twinkles of all luminosity and through the waves of cosmic consciousness. I behold him as the light of solar inspiration, holding the luminaries of my thoughts in the rhythm of balance. Like a silent, invisible river flowing beneath the sands, flows the vast, dimensionless river of spirit through the sands of time, through the sands of experience, through the sands of all souls, and through the sands of all living atoms, and through the sands of all space. I feel him as a bursting voice, leading, guiding, teaching secretly in the soul temple of all men and things in creation. He is the fountain of wisdom and radiant inspiration flowing through all souls. He is the fragrance oozing from the incense vase of all hearts. He is a garden of celestial blossoms and bright thought flowers. He is the love which inspired our love dreams. I feel him percolating through my heart, as through all hearts, through the pores of the earth, through the sky, and through all created things. He is the eternal motion of joy. He is the mirror of silence in which all creation is reflected. Can we not develop a love for that? And having that experience and knowing what Master knew. Master did not come to hold himself up as great and all others as less. Rather, he was constantly focused upon his beloved and encouraging us in every way that he could, even as Mother did, in order to attain that divine consciousness. Learn to love God, to serve God, to seek Him with discernment, and then to merge your little self into His vast self. And you will be born again. You will be twice born. And you will learn who and what you truly are in God. Will you pray with me? Oh, Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
I bow to the light within you.